I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And a warm welcome to Book Off, the literary podcast with a difference. I'm Joe Haddo, and wherever you're listening from, it's great to have you with us. And if you're new to Book Off, well, a warm, warm welcome. We hope you enjoy this new series, as well as all of our older episodes, which are available to listen to for free whenever you want. And to all our regular listeners who've been with us through thick and thin, our hugs and heartfelt thanks as always. It's great to have you with us too. Right then, on with our episode. And today, I'm joined by two titans of the book and film industries. My first guest is one of the world's most popular storytellers, having sold more than 40 million books worldwide. You can count them. Her novels have all been Sunday Times bestsellers and are published in 120 countries. She's the founder of the Save the Libraries Project, a non-profit which supports libraries and library programming, which I am very much a supporter of. And recently, her novel Pieces of Her was made into a Netflix series. Here to tell us about her brand new novel, Girl Forgotten, it's Karen Slaughter. Hello, Karen.
Hello.
Lovely to have you with us all the way from that there, America. And my second guest is a celebrated screenwriter and one of my favourites, actually, in all honesty, who's written more than 25 feature films. These include Jurassic Park, you might have heard of it, Death Becomes Her, Carlito's Way, Mission Impossible and Panic Room, to name just a few. He's also the author of two novels, Cold Storage and his brand new book, Aurora, which we'll be talking about today. David Capp, welcome to Book Off.
Thank you, Joe. Nice to be here.
And I should do the virtual intros here. Karen, David, David, Karen. Both in the States, but both very much in different parts of the US, I believe.
Yes, I believe. I don't know where you are, Karen.
I'm in Atlanta.
I'm in California for the moment. I live in New York.
Aha, there we go. And I don't believe you've met before, but you'll be firm friends by the end of this record, I'm sure, or enemies, depending on how the book off goes and how competitive you are. So over the next 30 minutes or so, we're going to talk about your brand new novels. We're going to talk a little bit about TV adaptations, a little bit about films. We're going to get some reading recommendations from you. And of course, we'll do the book off where each of you is going to tell us about a book you love that you think all of us should read. Firstly, Karen, though, if I could come to you and talk about Girl Forgotten. Now, am I right in thinking the inspiration for this new novel came when you were actually on the set for this Netflix adaptation of Pieces of Her, which we'll talk about in a minute. But is that where the inspiration for this novel came?
Well, it was actually reading the first script for the pilot, because I really, when I write standalones, I think it's really a standalone. I'm not one of these sneaky, well, let's see if people like it and I'll make it a series sort of writers. But I just started really thinking about the characters in the script and thought maybe there's another story to tell about Andrea, because she starts off in the book, and I'll speak to the book because the series is a little different, just as this kind of person that people my age generally hate, because she's, you know, she's a millennial, but she's having a really hard time being an adult, and she's still living with her mom, and she's, you know, in this crappy career, and she's covered up with student loans. And so I thought, you know, her journey in Pieces of Her is getting past that and becoming an adult. And, you know, unfortunately, there had to be a lot of people murdered in order for her to do that. But that's life.
Sure.
And so I thought, you know, I really want to talk about the fallout from that, because that's one thing I like to concentrate on in the books is not the violence, but what comes next. And how does that affect you? And how does that make you a different type of person? And so that's really what I thought when I read that pilot, was maybe there's another story about Andy and Laura that I can tell. And I love using that device of something horrible in the past coming to haunt you. So it really made sense to me to write this book from that perspective. You know, started off with a really bad crime that occurs that's very similar to what we have happening in Pieces of Her, and how does Andy deal with that?
And what was it, a tough decision or a strange decision for you to write Andy again, to bring her back?
It was, because, you know, I was talking to my editor about it, and I said the only reason I don't want to do this is because I don't want people to think I'm writing this because the show is coming out.
Right, yeah.
And actually, it, because of the pandemic, it really set things back. You know, it would have been out before the show, a couple of years after the show. But the pandemic shut down the shooting, and, you know, it delayed everything, and they had to move to Australia. And so, you know, it just kind of happened to work out that that was the book that came out now after the show. And she said, you know, what she always says, write the book you want to write. Don't worry about it. You know, fuck everybody else. If they love it, that's great. If they don't, we don't want to hear about it.
We'll come back and hear about it very shortly, Karen. David, if I could come to you to talk about Aurora, and to get the context of your new novel, we need to know about the Carrington event. So perhaps you could start by explaining that.
The Carrington event was in 1859. It was named after the British astronomer who observed it. And it was a coronal mass ejection from the sun, which is no big deal. They happen constantly. They happen several a day during periods of high solar activity. And they usually fire off into space and nothing's heard from them again. Occasionally, they make glancing contact with the Earth, cause a little bit of a power outage here and there. But in 1859, as it does every, say, 100 or 200 years throughout history, this mass of plasma energy hit the Earth directly. And it was 1859, so the ramifications were limited. It lit up the sky in aurora borealis that you could see all over the Earth for days on end. And it knocked out telegraph operations, because that was the only electrical system at the time. So I became curious, you know, as we all think about terrible things that might happen to us. I became curious about what would happen in today's modern world if there was a Carrington level ejection from the sun. But I didn't want to tell, you know, what would be a sort of globe-trotting disaster story, because we've seen those a million times in movies and read them in books, and they're fun, but it's just not what I wanted to do. I was interested in narrowing the focus to two people, and one extremely well prepared for some event like this, as some people do, and one completely unprepared. And then following their stories as perhaps unexpected things happen to each of them. You know, the one who's super prepared watches his life fall apart. The one who's unprepared discovers strength she didn't know she had. And then I made them siblings, because that just makes everything
work. Of course. Exactly. And we'll talk a little bit more about it shortly, David. Karen, perhaps you could just tell us about Emily Vaughan and set up this new story that Andy's in then for us.
Well, Emily Vaughan is a teenage girl, and she is part of this group of friends who she realizes very slowly through the book aren't the best friends to have. They're kind of these misfits, and they're held together by this kind of Manson-like figure, but a high school Manson, right? You know, where you get out of high school and you think, wow, that guy was full of shit. I can't believe he was so popular. But she's really in his thrall, and the whole group is. And it just takes one bad act for the group to turn on her. And it's about her trying to survive that and consequently, you know, being pushed out of the group in a really violent way. Because this, you know, my name's Slaughter for a reason. but, you know, honestly, it seemed at the time, I do tend to write about stuff that shouldn't be political, but actually is political. And one is, you know, this young girl who's trapped in a situation where she doesn't have a right to her own bodily autonomy, which really came to the forefront recently in America with the reversal of abortion and reproductive rights on the line. So, you know, in a way, it was really interesting to write because her parents are these extremely Reagan Republican type of people, you know, country club Republicans, which are, my God, who knew that we would long for those Republicans now, right? But, you know, it just seeing it from her family's perspective and what it does when a girl who's a quote unquote good girl does something bad and how it can really push her out of not just her little clique, but her away from her family, away from everything that she had in her life that she had plans for. And, you know, she has a very real connection to Andrea in a lot of ways, because the charismatic leader that she followed is the same one that a few years later, Andy's mother had the misfortune of meeting.
This may be slightly off topic, but can I just say, also, the thing I really admired in your book, Karen, is the mastery with which you're able to bounce between the two stories, because I don't give anything away by saying one takes place a while ago, one takes place now. You find that out early on. And it's, having tried that, now I'm a neophyte in novels. I've been doing movies for a long time, but it's only my second novel. And I found bouncing between two characters almost overwhelmingly difficult. It was to know exactly how much to give and to keep us want a track of where we were and fall back neatly into where we were when you go back to the other story. And I just thought you did that beautifully.
Well, thank you. It's really an honor to get that compliment from you, but it's something I've had a lot of practice on. I don't know if the first time I did it, I was so great. but also, you know, I'm taking a shot at writing a script for one of my books. And, you know, the thing about a novel is you have one perspective in each chapter. So that's so different from writing a script where I'm just having to constantly remind myself, wait a minute, you can express this thought or idea through another character and you're not violating that rule about, you know, one perspective. You know, sometimes authors in books will have like, you know, a paragraph from one person's perspective and a paragraph from the next person. And it just doesn't really work that way. You know, it's kind of breaking a rule, but it's been really hard in a script to think, oh, wait, yeah, I can go to that character's point of view immediately, and that's fine. So I'm doing the same thing you are, I guess, but in reverse.
What you can't do, which is maddening, is say what anyone is thinking or feeling. Unless they say it out loud, and who does that?
Right.
Didn't you say when you wrote Cold Storage that was one of the great things that you sort of loved about writing it, was that you could actually get into the thoughts and feelings of the characters?
Oh, I was giddy with with the freedom of it, because, you know, movie scripts, you have a few tools. You have what an audience might see, what an audience might hear, and that's about it. And I suddenly realized, you know, I wrote my first novel, I was in my 50s. So for 35 years, I've been doing things a certain way. And I realized, wait, I can just talk about the high school chemistry teacher that was so meaningful to her. I can digress. Then I quickly learned, yeah, digress. Just, you know, 3 pages is okay. But give us 12 pages on cricket. Nobody wants to read it. The freedom was intoxicating.
And in this new thriller, David, it's a great page turner, but it's made even more chilling, I think, by the fact that the events are actually plausible. And is that something that you wanted to play on, having told us already about how the spark for the novel came about?
Yes, I think that you know, there's a certain level of fantasy where you understand this will never happen or this is a world that will never exist, but it's fun and I'll go to it. And there's another kind of fantasy, which is the kind I've always been interested in the most, which is what if this happened and how can I make it believable? And then how might humans react? I mean, I think the most influential show for a lot of people in my generation who wanted to be writers was Rod Serling's original Twilight Zone, which was just a collection of great writers saying what if and making it seem terribly plausible.
That's so true, actually. Yeah, a lot of them were, even though I watched them a bit later. Even then I was like, oh, did this happen? Could it happen? It was still quite real in my mind. And in terms of ideas, David, because you've, as you said, this is your second novel and many screenplays down, as discussed. When you're thinking of stories, do you instinctively know, that's for the screen? Or actually, no, this could be a future David Kaplan? Is there a distinction there?
It's been too long. All movies are, see, that's a Freudian slip that'll answer your question. All stories occur to me as movies. That's just how the brain works. And with these two books, I've found, but wait, you can tell, even if it's a story that might be suited to a movie one day, you can tell this story in another way. And, you know, thankfully technology it has changed and, you know, there are other media to tell our story. I wrote something that was an audible, cause it was an impossible length. It was 60 pages and, you know, you can't do anything with that. It's far too long for a short story and nowhere near long enough for a novel, but, audible exists, which I guess isn't really new. It's just radio. But there are lots of places to tell your story. They do occur to me as movies, but then sometimes they bend into something else lately.
Yeah. 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 I understand that. Karen, I mentioned pieces of her being on Netflix, this new 8-part series. How has the reaction been so far? Have you sort of been following people, you know, who have been watching it, enjoying it? Or have you just been going, well, I'm done now?
Well, I want people to love it, but I have a tendency to only listen to the assholes. So over the years, I just kind of have divorced myself from it. You know, I remember like my first book, somebody gave me a 1-star review on Amazon because the jacket was torn. And I was just furious for that. Like for weeks, I was furious, like, oh, I need to write that person back. And it was just one of those things where I just had to step away from it. So, you know, and then another good thing is to have is if you believe the bad stuff, you have to believe the good stuff. And I can't do that. So I just don't pay attention. but also, you know, my one thing this experience has taught me is my book is my book and the show is the show. And they've actually been filming my Will Trent series, a pilot for that in Atlanta. Yeah. And I've kind of kept myself a few steps away from it because I'm writing a Will Trent book now and I don't want it to interfere because they need to be two really separate things. Because I just think it's important, you know, and I don't know, David, if you do this, because probably every book you write is an eye toward how you will adapt it maybe. So it's less seamless for you, but for me, I just have to keep them all separate.
I don't, it's only the two, books. So it's, but yeah, with both, it was impossible to write it and not have the screenwriting part of my brain's sort of plotting in the background about how I might do it. But it's interesting cause I'm working on, I've adapted a number of other authors' novels for movies. And I've always felt a ruthless disregard for them because I always felt the only thing I can't do is violate the spirit of the novel. I just, the tone and spirit of the novel, but there's such different media that we have to be able to interpret it. And the better movies where the author was then pleased were the ones where we took the most latitudes because we interpreted it and made it good for a movie. I'm working with a director now on the script version of Aurora, and it's different. It's different in tone. It's different. It's just different from the book because it represents her point of view. as it should. And she said, does this upset you? It's changing from the book. And I said, it only upsets me if you go and burn all the copies of the book. Then that would really be irritating. But the book is the book, and the movie is the movie. And they, as you said, Karen, they're separate entities, and they have to live that way.
Well, and the thing about a script, though, is everyone gets their shake at it, right? So you write it, and then the producer's like, no, change this. And then the, studio, whatever, no, change this. And then, I don't know, Tom Cruise comes along, and he's like, no, change this. So, everybody, it's so collaborative, which I fucking hate. Because when I write something, I think it's perfect, and I've given it a lot of thought. And, and that's one reason why I wanted to try to write a script, because I thought, I think you're really an asshole if you tell someone they're doing something wrong, but you don't know how to do it. Which would change the entire structure of the world if more people did that. So I understand why decisions are made now to truncate things or leave characters out or, whatever. But I also think that you should really pay attention to what the readers love about the book.
Yes.
Because that's there. And, also...
That's the DNA. That's what worked. You can't let it go.
But also plot-wise, I work really hard on the plot and make it very tight and very surprising because I read a shit ton of... I should have asked if I could curse. I was just assuming I can.
You can. Yes. I mean, too late for that now, I suppose. Yeah. But yeah, yes. You can. You absolutely can.
But I read a lot of crime novels, and so I know what as a reader you expect, and I try to go in the opposite direction. And I think that in that regard, following different plot points and twists sometimes, if they're really good in the book, is a better way to go than saying, well, let's come up with our own twist. But then I realize you get somebody like, a huge, massive star, and suddenly they need more of a story. So, it just really is interesting to see what you have to change and why you have to change it. Because and the author has very little to do with that. I mean, you, of course, you have more input on that, but they're not calling up Veronica Roth or Lee Child and saying, we decided to change this little thing. Is that okay with you? Because that's just not how it happens.
The few authors I've been in contact with when I'm adapting their work generally don't want to know. Because you're onto something else. You know that you can't control it. You can't change it. You can't convince people of things, and it's a waste of time to try. So they generally would rather not know.
And how many times would you sort of read... If you were adapting a novel, David, how many times would you read that, and what would the stages be to get it to screenplay? Or at what point do you then throw it away and go, right, I'm just concentrating on the script now?
After, generally, you read it once without taking any notes or anything to see if you like it.
And yeah.
You have something to contribute. And then the second time is normally because you're thinking, okay, now how do I do this? How might this be a movie? And you're taking a few notes. And the third time, I actually get out my little note cards and I outline the book as it exists because I want to see how the author did it. And it's fascinating. If you ever take the time to read a book three times and break out your cards and look at the structure of it, which is time consuming and I don't really recommend it. But it's fascinating because you start to see, oh, I bet that was a struggle. And, oh, I see how you did this. And, oh, look at, you're clever. You set that up back here. The sort of mystery falls away a little bit. Mm. And then from that, I start trying to compose what I think is a movie outline, which is different. 120-page script is a lot different from a 400-page novel. So just obvious things that have to be done. I'd say I stop reading the book for a good long while then while I'm doing drafts of the screenplay. And then I give it, if the movie's going, I give it another read before it's too late to see what did I miss that's brilliant? How far afield have we gone? Is there anything, are there nuggets I can still rescue and put in the script?
Right, okay. And Karen, are we allowed to know what script you're working on, or is that top secret at the moment?
Top secret.
Are you enjoying the process, though, so far?
Well, I am, but no one's given me any feedback yet. Okay. Other than, oh yeah, you can do this. This is great. Okay. You know, that kind of stuff that they always say in the beginning.
Wait, give it a few more months.
Yeah, they're not that different from, editors in that regard, I think. But, you know, the strange thing is I'm a very disciplined writer, and I don't really sit around and look at my navel a lot, which I think a lot of they're used to authors doing. So, you know, if I say I'm going to deliver this on Monday, then it's there on Monday and they're shocked.
Right.
But that's always how I've been. You know, I have to have a deadline and I have to work to that. Otherwise, you know, I also have a book to write and tours to do. So this is kind of a luxury to be able to do a side project in this way.
Yeah. But deadlines are important, especially when you have all those other things going on as well. You know, you need to know you're delivering that then, this part of the book then, you know, so important.
Well, mine is more like I've met a lot of people from my various publishing houses around the world, and I know exactly who I'm fucking over if I'm like, oh, I'm going to the beach, I'm not going to deliver this, right? Yeah. I mean, the translators, people who do the jackets, the marketing, the sales team, like thousands of people who can't do their jobs if I don't do my job. And that bothers me, you know, that bothers me quite a lot. And when I'm tired or whatever, I just think, well, you know, Adam needs to know the gist of the book for the marketing in the UK. So I need to stop watching Netflix and start writing.
That's very good of you, Karen.
Adam doesn't deserve it, but whatever.
Whatever, Adam. You think yourself lucky, Adam. Blimey.
That's right.
Before we get some reading recommendations from you both, David, I just want to talk about Steven Soderbergh, if I may, very briefly. One of my favourite directors and a very good friend of yours, I believe, of 30-odd years. And until very recently, you hadn't ever worked together, but you have collaborated recently on this HBO film, Kimmy, which came out earlier in this year. So how was that?
It was great. We were anxious because we tried to work together a couple times over the decades and couldn't.
Yeah,
just nothing clicked. And I had this idea for a movie, and we were having a drink one night, and I told it to him, and he said, "Yes, do that." Steven's very dynamic. There's a one or a zero with Steven. His response to an idea is always no or hell yes. There's no in between. So he was very positive about it. So I, you know, it noodled around for a while in my head, and then I wrote it and gave it to him, and he said, yes, let's do this. But we were a little anxious. It would be nice to come out on the other side with the friendship intact because you know, it's been nice and it's been decades. So, and thankfully, we did. It was a very smooth process. Because he does so much himself, he directs, you know, he's the director of photography, he edits, he has a deal with HBO Max that gives him a lot of independence and control. And because of, you know, who he is, his skill and reputation, you know, people tend to not fuck with him. So us agreeing on the screenplay was really the only thing that was ever going to be an issue. And we agreed quickly. And so it went sort of delightfully smoothly. And we got to and the movie turned out very well, I thought. So we got to the other side and said, well, that was close. Should we do another one? I don't know. Currently undecided.
Just constantly just trying to test that friendship now with a working relationship.
I'll write the story of his parents' divorce and see how that goes.
I always like to ask my guests what they've been reading and enjoying recently before we do the book off. Karen, I know you've got film scripts to write, books to write, tours to do, but I know you're also a voracious reader. So is there anything or anyone you've read recently that you've enjoyed that we should know about?
Well, Jennifer Hillier is one of my favorite authors, and she's got this new book, Things We Do in the Dark. And I don't, I'm looking at the jacket now trying to, I've got the galley. I don't know when it's coming out. But she also has another novel that's an older one called Jar of Hearts that just was fantastic. So she's one of my favorite, all-time favorites. So I would highly recommend people go back and look at her catalog. And when the next one comes out, I do not know when, enjoy that one as well.
Fantastic. I think it's a couple of months away here in the UK. But that's all right. We can wait. And there is pre-order available, of course. And David, what about you? Have you been reading and enjoying anything recently?
Well, in terms of new stuff, Blake Crouch, the American science fiction writer, has a terrific book coming called Upgrade. Comes out in July, but which I just loved. He's wonderfully imaginative, but he's also... You know, he's a humanist writer, and so it's there's a lot of feeling in it too. So Upgrade, I'd recommend. And I've also gone back lately. I wanted to reread stuff that I read when I was 17 or 18 years old, and see if I still felt the same way and why. So these are hardly new, but I tried to pick some books that were really formative for me. So I picked, I recommend all of them highly. I picked up some Kurt Vonnegut because I was 17 or 18 years old. He's brilliant. Bluebeard was the one I went with this time. It's great. It moved me as much this time as it did then. And I reread Stephen King's Dance Macabre, which is an overview of American horror film and literature that he wrote in the late 70s, and he updated in I think 2000 or so. And it's just this comprehensive examination of horror literature and film, what's great, why, and how it affected him. And it's also a writing memoir that sort of presages his On Writing, which is his great book directly about writing. So that's what I've been looking at.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. Thanks for both of them.
I'm trying to think of the shit I read when I was a kid. And it's Lace and Thorn Birds. What else? B.C. Andrews, Flowers in the Attic. I was really a filthy, filthy kid, I think.
It's interesting. If you look at it again, it's interesting how vividly you remember it. I mean, those years, those late teen, early 20 years, everything's sinking in and sticking and really forming things.
Yeah, I just remember I stole my sister's Flowers in the Attic, and she had like already turned the pages down to the good spots.
The naughty bits?
Yes, and like they were well worn. And then I was in college taking some class, I don't know, feminism something something. And of course, there was this one guy in there. You can imagine exactly who this guy was, right? And he starts railing against Flowers in the Attic. And it was like, oh my God, that's incest. I never realized that. It was just like this dawning moment for me. So that was nice. Yeah. If you're not familiar with Flowers in the Attic, it's a beautiful love story, but it's also incredibly gross and disgusting.
Quite a few different recommendations we've had there. Thank you both.
Yes.
And
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen,
premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
It's time for another from each of you, because it's time now for the Book Off. This is where each of you is going to tell us about a book that you love that you think we should all read, and you have 3 minutes uninterrupted to do so if you wish to use those 3 minutes. Now, what we usually do here, guys, the rules are the person that's travelled the furthest gets to choose whether they go first or second. Now, I'm saying that's you, David, from over there in California. So would you like to go first or would you like to go second?
Oh, I've been anxious about this for days. I'd like to go second and postpone my anxiety.
I'd like to say that I lied. I'm actually in Australia.
Yeah. Too late now, Karen. Karen, as the second choice, you get to decide how you are rudely interrupted at your 3 minute mark. Do you want the school bell or would you like the bicycle horn?
Can you do both?
Ooh, I'm not sure anyone's asked me that. For you, yeah. Okay.
I want it all.
You want it all. And that means, David, you can have it all as well.
All right, thank you.
Yeah. All right.
All right, Karen. So just before we start the 3 minutes, just tell us the book that you're putting forward for us.
It's Booth by Karen Joy Fowler. Hopefully, I never remember author names. Yeah, so Google that if you're interested.
Well, it's 3 minutes on the clock then, Karen, and it's over to you uninterrupted to tell us about Booth.
Okay, well, when I started reading it, I didn't realize how topical it would be. I mean, I read Manhunt earlier a few years ago about the hunt for John Wilkes Booth, and he's the guy who assassinated Lincoln, in case your listeners aren't familiar with American history. So it's about the Booth family. So John Wilkes Booth was an actor, but I didn't realize he came from an entire family of actors. And his father was amazingly famous. And he lived in England, and he moved the family to America, you know, land of opportunity. And John Wilkes Booth had two other brothers. He had something like 11 siblings, which wasn't unusual then because a lot of them died. But the family was really, really into acting, really into Shakespeare. And one of John Wilkes Booth's brothers actually was credited with bringing Shakespeare into a normative language. You know, they didn't speak it in that stylized way. They spoke Shakespeare's words as if they were communicating with each other at the dinner table. So it launched his career as this Shakespearean actor, and he was so popular he even dined at the White House with Abraham Lincoln. But the really fascinating part to me was about John Wilkes Booth and how he became radicalized. And part of the problem was he was sent to a boarding school with a lot of extremely wealthy plantation class Southerners who were slave owners themselves. And, you know, they told him all about slavery and, oh, it's not so bad. You know, the people really want to be enslaved because they wouldn't know what to do otherwise with their time. And so John Wilkes Booth really bought into that whole bullshit story of the plantation class, that, you know, this sense of noblesse oblige and we're giving them something to do and they're godless savages. And one of the real radicalizing moments from him was a case I had never heard about, where some slaves escaped, or I should say enslaved people escaped, and they went north to try to find their freedom, and there ended up being a massacre. And that was really something that sparked in John Wilkes Booth. And it kind of reminded me of what Waco did for Timothy McVeigh, who eventually set off a bomb in the Murrah building and murdered a bunch of people at this federal building in Oklahoma City. And it really has parallels to what's going on today. I mean, we all have cousins who are radicalized the same way John Wilkes Booth was. And as I'm wrapping this up, because I am timing this too, it's what's most fascinating is just how freaking stupid these people were. That's the only reason they didn't succeed.
Boom. Look at that. Give me a bit of that. I see. You got it. You got your own timer. I see. You're clever. Very clever.
I do, yeah.
Thank you very much for that pitch. Loved it. We're going to come back and talk about it shortly. It was recommended before as well, that which means it must be a brilliant, brilliant book because lots of people are talking about it. Anyway, have a breather, Karen. That was fab. I'm putting 3 minutes back on the clock for you, David, and just before we start that, tell us the book you're putting forward, please.
I'm also doing Booth. I'm doing the 1954 novel I Am Legend by Richard Matheson.
Fantastic. Alrighty, 3 minutes on the clock uninterrupted, should you wish to use it, to tell us about I Am Legend. Over to you.
Okay, if you could interrupt with the horn thing, but also by shouting give way.
Okay.
And I'll feel like I'm in Parliament. It'll be great. Okay, so I Am Legend is a 1954, technically a horror novel by Richard Matheson. Everyone knows of Richard Matheson, even if you think you don't. He wrote most of the best Twilight Zones, a show I referred to earlier. He was just in a dozen or more novels that are just brilliant. What Dreams May Come, I Am Legend. He wrote Duel, Spielberg's first movie, Richard Matheson story of the truck and the Dennis Weaver and in the desert. It's just genius. But Matheson, the reason I Am Legend is so powerful to me is because it's a humanist horror novel. It's about a vampire plague. I'll get to that in a second. But it's really about human loneliness. It's a last person on earth story. And the desolation and desperation of a lonely man. He's the last. There's been a plague which has turned most of the population of the earth into vampires. And what was remarkable about that in 1954 is no one had suggested. He completely reinterpreted the vampire myth. Since Bram Stoker, no one had attempted another explanation other than a supernatural one of why vampires exist. And Matheson decided to go into the science of it and suggest that a bacterial infection that became a pandemic was the reason behind it. And so over the course of this book, this character goes into a lot of research and figures out why and how people became vampires. But in the day, they besiege him and try to kill him. So at night, he has defenses. He's created his home as a fortress. And at night, he goes out and kills them in great numbers. And but it really, all along, what's pulling us through it is his terrible loneliness. And another character, a woman, shows up third or halfway through the book. And you're just so touched for him. And they connect. And it's just, there's another survivor. And it's beautiful. And you realize that you have a sense early, but you come to realize she's not human. She's one of the vampires, and they've come to figure out who is he, who is this monster that comes out and kills us at night. And what's magnificent about the book is, I won't give away its ending, but in the last third, there's a complete shift in perspective of whose story this is, who is the monster, and what is life like for another human being. And I just thought,
make way.
I thought that was
good. That was personal. I was getting into wonderful. That. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, I was into it. I didn't want to interrupt it. So I feel bad, but that's the game. Brilliantly put, David. Coming back to you shortly, Karen, if I can just talk about Booth very quickly. And as I said, this is the second pitch we've had for Booth. And I remember thinking the last time someone spoke about it, not really know, you know, I'm a bit underread and under knowledgeable about American history, but I certainly didn't really know much more about the Booth family. John Wilkes Booth, sure, we've heard of, know a bit maybe about, but when you were talking about, you know, the family come from sort of acting stock, how famous they were, you know, what his brothers brother did with Shakespeare. I mean, all of that stuff is just magnificent stuff you wouldn't necessarily learn over here, but actually you pick up from this book. So I take it's a sort of quite a good history lesson, especially for people like me.
Well, and also a lot of Americans. I mean, I said it wasn't successful, but people don't realize that the assassination plot was one of many. You know, they went after the Secretary of State at the time. They wanted to get Andrew Johnson, They were really bad at what they did. You know, this one guy went nuts and just started stabbing everybody, and he got caught. And the other guy was drunk and he lost his nerve. And, you know, of course, Booth, he jumps from the balcony to the stage and he breaks his ankle and he gets caught by that. But, you know, it really was interesting just how the family suffered because of what he did. And some of them, you know, at first they were all appalled, but then a little later, some other family members became more sympathetic just because, you know, if enough people hate you, generally you start to group together and think that the haters are wrong. But it really was fascinating to read. But I think maybe David can speak to this also. We Americans know so very little about our history, like the true history of America and all the different things that, you know, horrible things that have happened. And I mean, we just had Memorial Day, and I would guarantee most Americans don't know that it was started by formerly enslaved people who in Charleston dug up a mass grave of Union soldiers and gave them proper Christian burials, right? And that's where Memorial Day comes from. But I guarantee you the vast majority of Americans celebrating that holiday, which honors fallen soldiers, have absolutely no idea how that started.
Yeah. It's true. And actually, the first time I heard that was, I think it was the not long after the year after the George Floyd riots. There was a military figure who was speaking on that subject and trying to tell people how this holiday actually started, and they pulled his microphone. He wasn't particularly radical in his approach. He was just providing a full context of how the holiday began, and whoever was in charge at the event turned him off rather than hear the truth, which isn't even, it's not a particularly divisive truth. It just happens to be how it started.
And it's kind of awesome, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's really amazing that they did that. There's so many stories like that are lost to history. I think that's why I enjoyed Booth so much, because, you know, I knew, okay, he shot Lincoln. Wasn't particularly a good shot, so Lincoln suffered. And also a doctor named Mudd helped him, which is where we get the phrase, his name is Mudd. Because it was, I forget his first name, but Dr. Mudd for many, many years. Yeah. Well, his name was Mudd for helping John Wilkes Booth.
Oh, wow. That's great. And also what you said, Karen, of course, which I really took from your pitch, is that, you know, the parallels of what's going on today, looking back on the story of this family and that assassination, but also just like reading it in 2022 and the parallels being very, you know, prescient in that sense. But I love that pitch, and I must read this book because I've heard so much about it now. And David, I Am Legend, wow, what a book, eh? And I don't think I knew that he wrote Duel, actually. So this is, I'm learning things all round from these pitches. I didn't know that at all. But I know this book, and I love how you sort of said what it really is about. You know, that yes, you could say it's a sort of humanist horror vampire story, but it's really about human loneliness, and you're absolutely right. And the things that you sort of picked out about it, I just love, you know, the thing that pulls us through the story is his terrible loneliness and that sort of connection with who we think is another survivor and everything, you know, the ups and downs of this novel. The fact that, you know, he completely reinterpreted the vampire myth and no one had done that until 1954, until this book came along, you know, just, it's just brilliant. And I absolutely loved it. And I imagine this might be one of those books that you have sort of read and reread quite a bit.
I have. I didn't come to it till my late 30s, I think. I don't know why. I'd never quite had the penny drop on Matheson, though I loved his stuff without knowing it for decades. But what's also important about the book is it's reinterpretation of vampirism or zombieism as a disease rather than something caused by, you know, something supernatural. That changed everything. If you look at the and if you look at the current in zombie movies of the last 50 years, George Romero openly admitted, I took this from I Am Legend. This is how I came up with this idea. I'm not sure how wise that is to say in the press about your but I guess he and Matheson know. So it was fine. But you know, all of that has descended from I Am Legend. Nobody did that before that. So I think it's like with Booth and, you know, understanding a bit of history and where things come from. I think it's also important, you know, with literary and film things, where did that trend start? Who did that? Where did that idea come from? What we're all building on other people's ideas for thousands of years, but sometimes we don't quite realize what the origin of those ideas was.
Yeah, absolutely. I loved both of these pictures, and I thought you both did a fabulous job for both books. I can only take one home, though, and that's a toughie. So I'm going to take I Am Legend. I'm going to take I Am Legend because I think I took Booth last time, Karen, so that's nothing to do with you, but I think I'm just balancing it out.
Bullshit. I was robbed.
But I must read Booth. Honestly, I can't tell you how many people are recommending it. But I think for the sheer fact that of how much it changed, I think I Am Legend has to be taken today. But both fabulous books and suggestions, and two other fabulous books that I can recommend are Aurora by David Capp, which is out now. It's published by HQ. And Girl Forgotten by Karen Slaughter, which is also out now and it's published by HarperCollins. And you should get these in your hands and read them and enjoy them. Karen, David, what an absolute pleasure to spend this time with you. Thank you for your recommendations. Thanks for the book off, and very much look forward to seeing you in person when you're over here in little old UK.
Thank you.
Thank you, Joe.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.